Hi, and welcome to episode 5 of The Lawdown, a podcast from CM Murray. I'm Beth Hale, I'm technical director at CM Murray.
And I'm Sarah Chilton, a partner at CM Murray.
So today we're going to be covering a few topics. First of all, we're going to talk about big bonuses and the Persimmon boss who's recently left the company. We're also going to talk about microchipping employees, which seems like a horrifying idea to me, yep. But we'll talk about it later. We're going to talk about the sexual harassment scandal currently taking over the House of Lords, and then we're going to talk about Article 50 and Brexit.
So Beth, to get us started, the former boss of Persimmon, which is a house building company, has just received an enormous bonus, or that's how it's been reported, and there's been quite a lot of controversy around that. What has been going on in the company? Yeah.
So Jeff Fairburn, who was the CEO of Persimmon, was part of this long-term incentive plan, so it was essentially a sort of bonus scheme, which in which he earned a bonus which depended on the share price of the company. Now, during his tenure as CEO, there's been a huge increase in the share price, and that means that he has earned, under that LTIP scheme, a bonus which was reported to be about £100 million.
Wow.
In shares. So it wasn't a sort of cash payout now. It was a paid over some time in shares. But this caused huge public outcry, and there was also outcry amongst the shareholders of the company. And as a result of that outcry, he has actually, A, agreed to a reduced pay award. So he's reduced from 100 million to 75 million, is what's been reported. But also, he has left the company at the request of the company, but apparently by mutual consent. But he still stands to receive 75 million of the bonus that he had apparently earned.
There's other reports that say that he's not the only one in the company to receive a huge payout this year to this bonus time. I think that it was reported that the finance director was also going to receive something in the region of about £84 million. Mm-hmm. And there has, however, been lots of criticism from politicians, charities and corporate governance experts about this. And what are their main concerns?
Well, the main concerns are really just that they're over-rewarding these people, and that really, certainly in light of things like the Carillion collapse last year, that companies ought to be not making these enormous payouts to people, and that what can anyone do which justifies a bonus that big? I mean, 100 million is an enormous amount of money, you know, more than most people would dream of earning in their lifetime. Mm. And so the objection is really just about the quantum. Mm.
I suppose it's interesting, though, to think about why bonuses are paid and different types of bonuses you get. So although this has been reported as a bonus, you said it's part of a long-term incentive plan.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me that actually the reason that the number is so high, one of the reasons, rather, is because the share price has gone up. So he has presumably been awarded shares, and the current value of those shares is large, whereas
yes.
they might drop, or he might have otherwise been awarded the same number of shares that wouldn't have attracted that same value.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it was connected to the share price and the increase in the share price during his... was performance-related.
Yeah.
And so the argument from his side, I guess, is that he had performed very well. Mm. The company had done very well under his direction, and he's therefore received a big amount of money.
Yeah. I suppose the other thing to think about in terms of bonuses is, well, why do employers award bonuses? There are multiple reasons. It's to reward past performance. But another reason is to incentivize people to stay and to work hard in the future. And I suppose the larger a bonus is, when we're talking about really, really big sums like that, I'm not sure personally how incentivized I'd be if I was just to receive £75 million. I might be more incentivized to stop working, set up a foundation, travel the world or something like that. But as you say, you know, different underlying reasons as to why it's that number, it doesn't sound at least as though someone has said, I'm going to give you £75 million. It seems like it's been a product of the structure of the scheme in place at the time.
Yeah, and what's difficult about this is that, you know, there was a lot of criticism levelled at the banks for rewarding failure, and that, you know, huge bonuses were paid out for people who weren't successful and who were, in fact, causing losses to their employer. Well, that's not the case here. He genuinely
performing well
and had made the company very successful. So it was a bit of a tricky one. And essentially what they said is that his presence as CEO was causing a distraction, and that's why he had to go.
Mm. Because of all the media?
Because of all the media attention, basically, and the attention from shareholders of the company. But it's quite a tricky one because actually, you know, they put in place this scheme. Mm. It wasn't his decision. It was a company decision. It was a board decision. And, you know, so that he should lose his job over it seems... a bit strange, I think, given that he was successful. Although, obviously, the figures seem absolutely huge.
Exactly, to most people. Interesting. And so the next thing on the agenda for today is something that I'm quite interested in, which is microchipping.
Yes, something talk to us about that.
Normally associated with pets.
Yes.
But at the moment, associated with employees. This story has hit the press because there have been reports that there are companies offering microchipping to employees. And it's also been reported that some UK companies might actually take these offerings up and try and microchip their employees. Now, the way it works practically is that the microchip is inserted between in the skin between your thumb and your forefinger. It's apparently the size of a grain of rice, Beth's holding up her hand and looking at where it would fit. And the technology in it is the same sort of technology that you have in mobile phones and bank cards. It's the near-field communication technology that allows us to pay contactless. And apparently it can be used for lots of different things. So it can be a substitute for something like a contactless payment card. It can store data, so it can store medical data and other types of data. And last year it was reported that 100 commuters on a Swedish train operator had actually used microchips inserted under the skin to pay for their rail fares.
So we could use them instead of Oyster cards?
Yeah, I think that's the idea.
And presumably instead of entry cards for getting in and out of your office.
So that's where the discussion has really come into the employment arena, because people are saying that actually instead of carrying a pass around with you, which you might lose or you might misplace or you might leave in the lift, you could just have this microchip in your hand and you just wave your hand on front of the sensor and the door would open. It's also been discussed that it could do a little bit more than that. So for example, someone wrote that it might be helpful for businesses like finance and law. I have to say, I'm not really keen on it coming into our arena, which have sensitive data. So obviously we deal with a lot of client confidential information. And it's been suggested that we could use microchips to restrict people's access. So you would only give the people with certain microchips access to certain documents. So whilst you're sitting at your desk, presumably you would wave your hand over something and you would be able to access certain documents and other people wouldn't be able to access those documents.
It feels very Minority Report, doesn't it?
It feels very weird. And apparently a UK firm have implanted 150 microchips in UK individuals. Most of them apparently were for individuals, i.e., you know, people just going and buying them, which I can't quite understand what's motivating them to do that, because I don't know at the moment what you can use them for, because there's not widespread sort of acceptance of microchipping, unless, of course, you can get your bank card made into a microchip. But there have been some apparently inserted into staff, and apparently in some financial and engineering companies in the UK, the staff have been implanted with microchips.
And what are the issues with that, do you think, from a sort of employment law perspective?
Well, there's been lots of concerns raised. So both the CBI, which is the business institution, and the TUC, workers representatives, have voiced concern. The TUC's main concern relates to the eroding of workers' right to privacy. Some employers have come out and said that they would never use them under any circumstances. So KPMG have said that. They just said that we wouldn't use them. I think there are quite a lot of issues if you were an employer thinking about microchipping an employee. Obviously, it's a monitoring of those employees. And I mean, I think from a personal perspective, one of the things that freak me out a little bit is the fact that it's in you all the time. So, you know, with your work pass, you can take it home at the weekend on a Friday night and put it in a drawer and not think about it. So you don't have it on you. And anyway, it doesn't have the technology to track you. But let's just say, you know, that microchip had the ability to know where you were, then your employer would basically know where you were at all times.
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be, if it's that sort of near technology like contactless.
Yeah.
I suppose it's not a GPS tracker.
No, that's true. Well, not at the moment.
Not at the moment, but it's potentially a slippery slope.
If it stores data, I mean, it must have to store some data about you to enable you to use it, say, for accessing doors and documents and computers, then it gets into the territory of personal data under the data protection law that we have in the UK and across Europe. And arguably storing that sort of information about people, it's been suggested that it might store medical information about people, that would be sensitive data about somebody. And any employer using that sort of technology, we'd have to really conduct really strict risk assessment as to what they were going to use it for, and they meant to conduct privacy impact assessments for things like that. There's an argument even whether or not this type of monitoring would require the employer to consult with the Information Commissioner's office before they actually rolled it out. slightly different to this, but it was reported before that some employers were using other sorts of biometric data identifying type systems for employees. One might be facial recognition, which I think is already really common in certain phones. And the other one is fingerprint recognition, obviously. And I think fingerprint recognition is something that people would use for, say, clocking in and clocking out of a workplace.
Yeah, or logging into a computer. I mean, I've had a computer where you swipe your fingerprints to get onto the computer. So that's...
The facial recognition, though, is an interesting one.
Yeah, it is. So there was some data published last year about some facial recognition software, which was used in the States, and they did a study with it. And they had, I think, something like 90% accuracy of detecting sexual orientation on the basis of just a facial recognition piece of software. So it's really extraordinary the kind of stuff you can get from what seems like not very much information.
Yeah, and from an employment perspective, I suppose what the employer's got to always think about is if they're using these sorts of things that gives them that sort of information, whether that be someone's sexual orientation or medical information about a disability, then they have information that they might not otherwise have. And then they've got knowledge of that information, and that engages issues such as potential discrimination.
Absolutely. And I think employers really need to know why they want all this information.
Yeah.
Why do they want it? What are they going to do with it? And is putting a microchip in someone a sort of proportionate way of getting that, of achieving that?
Because I think there's also the kind of privacy issues engaged the Human Rights Act. Yeah, and that's one of the issues that's been really raised by those who are concerned about that. It engages Article 8 of the European Convention of Human Rights, and that's the right to private life, and that's something that people have really expressed an issue with in respect of this idea. So I don't know where it'll go. These two companies, this UK company have been reported that do it, and a Swedish company, and apparently there is such interest in microchipping in the UK that the Swedish company are planning to set up an office in London in the near future. So they cost between £70 and £260 for anyone who's interested in getting one. I think I'll be at the bottom of that list.
Me
not
too.
Really, not really something that I'm up for. But, you know, might work for some. Moving on from microchipping to what I think we feel is a topic that we can't get away from. And in a way, that's good because it means it's being discussed and things are changing and it's more out in the open. But in a way, it's sort of depressing because every week we come back to record this podcast and think we're not going to have a story about sexual harassment in the press this week because nothing big has happened. And then every week something does happen. From that perspective, it's quite sad that these things are still kind of coming out.
This is another one of historical, it's a historical allegation, and it concerns Lord Leicester, who's a barrister, but also a member of the House of Lords. An allegation has been made. It was initially anonymous, but the person making the allegation has now waived her right to anonymity. And I think there are a number of issues coming out of this case, and the sort of facts have been reported quite widely. But essentially, what she says happened is that around 12 years ago, Lord Leicester took her to his house, sexually harassed her, and then subsequently at the House of Lords, basically told her that he would make her a baroness within a year if she would sleep with him. He denies all the allegations, and there's been an investigation carried out by the Committee for Privileges and Conduct at the House of Lords. And I think one of the most interesting things is the process that's been followed and how the investigation was carried out. And what Lord Leicester says is that the process is unfair, largely because he says he wasn't given the opportunity to cross-examine her either directly or indirectly. And that's quite an interesting thing in terms of internal procedures and when investigations are carried out into this type of allegation and how employers are expected to carry out those investigations. I mean, it's quite rare, I think, in an internal investigation for two employees to be sort of faced against each other in a hearing and be given the opportunity to cross-examine one another. I think we would generally recommend that isn't done,
mm-hmm.
although you would say that people's sides of the story ought to be challenged, people's accounts of what happened ought to be challenged,
yeah.
and the challenges put to them, if someone's raising a challenge and saying this is not true because X, Y, Z, that challenge should be put to the other person. And that did certainly happen in this case. So if you read the report, it's very long, but essentially they did. They said they put her account to him. He said this is not true because of these mm-hmm. things. they put those challenges to her and she was given a chance to respond, and then he was given a further chance to respond. So, I mean, it reads as a very thorough investigation. Mm. And she had 12 witnesses who came forward, I think, and said that she told them about it at the time. And I think that was a really important mm-hmm. determining factor for the committee, mm-hmm. was that she had this contemporaneous evidence of people who said, yes, she told me about it 12 years ago when it happened.
It's an interesting point. It's actually something I was discussing yesterday with someone else in relation to an alleged perpetrator of sexual harassment questioning, in fact, this was in the context of an employment tribunal, questioning the victim and whether or not that alleged perpetrator as an individual would be able to cross-examine the victim in relation to their account. It's probably quite an unusual situation, but it potentially would come up if an individual respondent was a named person in a sexual harassment claim.
And if they weren't represented in the employment tribunal, they could be.
They could.
If they had no lawyer, they could be doing that cross-examination in an employment tribunal.
And it came up, the issue more generally came up in the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the inquiry basically recommended that this be looked at in the context of civil proceedings. So there are particular rules in criminal proceedings which look to protect vulnerable witnesses in this kind of context, and there are ways that that can be done. They use different mechanisms. They might have intermediaries involved, and they might have video conferencing link and things like that.
Yeah.
And there are rules to prevent the accused in a sexual assault situation from actually cross-examining the victim. But there are no such equivalent rules in civil procedure at all for these sorts of things. Now, what judges have done is develop, you know, rules or protocols per case, and you know, I think there's discretion in the judiciary to do that, but it's an interesting point when you then translate that into an internal procedure. I think actually there's much more scope for an employer to say no to
absolutely. I mean, it's an internal procedure, it's there, it's the employer's procedure, and I think they, you know, it would create a kind of mini court
trial,
mini trial if they tried to do that. I mean, I think absolutely evidence should be challenged and people should be given the opportunity to challenge what is said about them, but that in an internal employment process that shouldn't probably be done like face to face by the two people involved in the allegations.
And just to say that this obviously isn't an employment process, but it's very similar. The way that it's been investigated is similar. It's a civil process. It's a sort of internal procedure as opposed to a formal civil claim in the courts or opposed to any criminal allegation.
Yes, and that important to remember as well, that the standard of proof is the civil standard of proof, which is balance of probabilities and not beyond reasonable doubt. And that's very much stressed in the report, is that they were relying on the sort of balance of probability. So is it more likely than not to have happened? And so they listened to both accounts, they listened to the evidence of witnesses. The House of Lords have to vote on the suspension. So the committee have suggested that Lord Leicester be suspended from the House of Lords until for 4 years, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's the longest suspension ever proposed. And the House of Lords have to vote on that proposal. But it's interesting that the initial stage suggested expulsion.
Yeah.
And that was downgraded on appeal to suspension.
It does seem, I mean, from obviously we deal with suspensions that are much shorter, and typically as employment lawyers we don't deal with suspensions as a sanction, we deal with suspensions as a precautionary measure whilst an investigation is ongoing.
Yeah.
It's a very different type of suspension, but 4 years does seem slightly odd in that it seems so long that really what's the difference between expulsion and suspension?
It seems strange. And I think that there were some technicalities around why they suggested suspension rather than expulsion. Largely, I think, because expulsion wasn't a sanction available at the time that the alleged offence happened.
Ah, okay. That's
and so I think that was the main reason for the downgrading expulsion to... Yeah. So I think if this happened now, if these allegations were made about something that happened, say, in 2018, then expulsion would be available as a sanction. But I think because it's a historic allegation, that's the main reason why it was downgraded.
And one of the other issues that has come up with this is whether or not, for example, in this context, Lord Leicester, as you say, is a barrister, he's a member of Barristers' Chambers, and whether or not they should be doing something in the same way that an employer may be expected to do something if an employee is accused of misconduct outside the work, but which, if done inside the workplace, may be grounds for dismissal, for example. And so that's a difficult decision that will have to be taken by his colleagues as to whether or not they consider this alleged conduct to be relevant to what he does as a barrister, and you know, whether in fact they've got any internal codes of conduct or procedures which govern this, which require them to take action or not take action.
It's complicated again by the fact that barristers aren't employees. They're self-employed, and barristers' chambers have written constitutions which will govern kind of how they deal with misconduct.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I think there is, as you say, that issue where someone might be convicted, an employee might be convicted of a criminal offence. This isn't a criminal offence. What's alleged here is not criminal, but where an employee is convicted of a criminal offence outside of work, something totally unrelated, and whether they then are disciplined internally. And I think that really depends on the situation and whether the offence and the reporting of the offence and what has happened impacts on the individual's ability to do their job. Yeah.
Or brings the company into disrepute.
Absolutely, yeah.
One really common thing that we see are social media issues. Yeah. So it's very different to sort of criminal offences, but sometimes they are criminal offences, but someone will say something abusive, for example, or racist or a sexist on social media and potentially get disciplined for that. And the law basically says that you've got to, as an employer, actually show that there's likely damage to the reputation of your business. In a situation where someone said something bad about your business, for example, on social media.
So if you have a YouTube video that someone's put up which contains kind of abusive content,
yeah,
but it's only been viewed twice, then it's hard for the employer then to show that they've suffered any reputational damage.
Yeah.
There was a case last week of Ryanair who sacked some staff
for
some social media content where they posted photos of themselves sleeping on the floor in the Spanish airport.
Why did they do that? What was the publicity?
They were basically saying, look at what a terrible employer Ryanair is. Our flights were delayed and we had to
sleep on the floor. Because they didn't give them a hotel.
Well, that's what they said. Turns out, Ryanair say they did give them a hotel and that the photo was actually staged, and the six employees who, the crew members who put that photo onto social media who were in the photo have all been sacked. So remains to be seen whether they seek to bring any claims against Ryanair as a result of that.
It's been an interesting time for Ryanair because they obviously had that other story in the press where there was an accusation that they didn't deal appropriately with a passenger who was racist to a fellow passenger.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that was an interesting one as well.
Not a great month for their PR team.
They seem to do all right despite having a lot of negative PR.
This is great, amazing short-haul flights that they offer us so much cheaper than everyone else. Absolutely. They encourage us to go on holiday. Talking of short-haul flights, should we talk about Brexit?
Yes.
And let's hope we can still take those short-haul flights across to Spain after the day that we will leave the EU next.
So there's obviously a huge amount that we could be saying about Brexit, but actually today we're going to focus on just one particular issue, which is the court process that's going through the Scottish courts at the moment and been referred up to the ECJ about whether Article 50 can be unilaterally revoked.
Yes, so this was a case that was brought by a cross-party group of six MPs, MSPs and MEPs, led by Andy Whiteman of the Scottish Green Party. And the group were essentially seeking clarification as to the question of whether Article 50 could be unilaterally revoked, because there is some discussion that in fact it cannot be unilaterally revoked by the UK government and that instead it needs the consent of the other 27 EU member states. The Article 50 notification was obviously the trigger for the UK's exit from the EU. And there is a question as to whether or not, if the UK government were so minded, it might in fact be able to revoke that and keep us in the EU. So the case initially went to the Court of Session Outer House, which is the first division of the Court of Session in Scotland. And the judges there rejected the application of the petitioners. And then the petitioners, that's the six cross-party group, that's the people asking the court to do something in Scotland, they then sought an appeal. They went up to the inner house of the Court of Session, which is the highest court you can get in Scotland, and they asked that court to review the decision. And that court did hear the appeal and they found in favour of the petitioners. So the Lord.
Why did the first court reject it?
The first court rejected it because they said that the issue was hypothetical. Now, arguably it is hypothetical because we don't know what the government will want to do. But a lot of people would argue that in fact the government needs to be informed and
ought to know whether that is an option open to them.
Yeah. But the on appeal, the court said, in fact, it's constitutionally significant and
not academic and hypothetical, and that's the basis on which they let the appeal through and made the reference to the European Court. But then the UK government disagreed with that, and they sought leave to appeal to the Supreme Court, and that leave was rejected by the Court of Session. And then they went ahead and further tried to seek leave to the appeal from the Supreme Court directly.
And the Supreme Court have now turned down that application, so they've said that they won't hear the appeal either. So the hearing at the ECJ, the European Court, is now going to go ahead, and they've put it through a kind of expedited process, is that right?
Yeah, they have. So it's due to go ahead on the 27th of November, so pretty soon. And thankfully, in time enough, I think, before any critical decisions about Brexit will be taken, and certainly before March 2019. And there was definitely a fear that if the UK government had got their Supreme Court hearing on this, that might have delayed matters to the extent that the government wouldn't have known if it was even an option to revoke Article 50 before such time as we were actually due to leave the EU altogether.
It seems strange to me that the government would want to prevent that from happening, but
That they would want to take decisions without having the full facts available to
indeed.
Them, but not, you know, things maybe not surprising anymore in these difficult
times. Nothing surprises me.
So we will, hopefully by the next episode of the Lawdown, we will know what's happened before the ECJ. We will unlikely have any decision from the ECJ, but I think based on the fact it's on an expedited procedure, we could expect the judgment quite quickly as well as the hearing. And so that will hopefully inform our politicians as to what their options are.
Absolutely.
So that's all we've got time for on this episode of The Lawdown. We hope you have enjoyed listening. Do rate us and review us on iTunes and other apps if you can, if you like what you're hearing, so that we can be discovered by more people. And if you want us to talk about any particular stories or have any questions, please get in touch with us. The information for our contact details is in the podcast notes, and we look forward to speaking to you on the next episode.
Thanks very much for listening.